So thank you very much. This session, you know, all of the occupational health and safety sessions are dedicated to someone, and this one's dedicated in memory of Crystal Eastman. And I'm going to point that out because of one thing in the back of the program. They talk about everybody, and it's really cool. So one of the things she did was that she had her master's in sociology and a law degree, and after graduate in New York, and after graduation in 1907, she helped with the first major survey on workplace deaths. And then she went on in her career to do a lot of work on finding out how many injuries and illnesses and work-related deaths there were. So that's pretty cool, and you'll see why that's important in my talk. And then another person that is mentioned is George Becker, who was a former president of the United Steelworkers and worked very hard on occupational health and safety. And it was really interesting to note that he began researching hazards in lead and attended medical conferences, sometimes as the only non-physician in the room, to tell them what he was seeing out in industry. And at one conference, he was accused of lying about the widespread industry practice of prophylactic chelation because no ethical physician would do such a thing. You'll see why I mentioned that. Okay. I have no disclosures. So what I'm going to do is tell you about medical management practices that we are seeing during OSHA investigations, and talk about how these practices affect underreporting and underrecording of work-related injuries and illnesses, and then talk about how those affect workers' health and really primary prevention, and then maybe some things that we can do to change those practices. And I need to give you a little background on the OSHA record-keeping rule for anyone who doesn't know what that is. That's a standard that OSHA has that companies need to write down work-related injuries and illnesses on the infamous OSHA 300 log. That's important because it's used by BLS as the basis for their statistics on occupational injuries and illnesses. If they don't record everything, we go in when we do inspections and look at the OSHA 300 logs, and if they haven't recorded it, the things they're supposed to, then they get a citation, and that's called under-recording. Now, in 2009, the GAO did this study to see how well is the OSHA record-keeping rule working, and the reason they did that was that there was research that showed that there was statistics for work-related injuries and illnesses in industries by BLS tended to be falsely low, and so they were looking at why that was. And they found that when they talked to workers, that many workers were afraid to talk about their injuries and report them to the company, so that's under-reporting, because they were afraid to lose their jobs. Companies had incentive and disincentive, and still do, incentive and disincentive programs. So incentive programs to discourage workers from reporting because they would get bonuses if they had low or no injury rates. And disincentive programs like point systems. So if you miss work, you get a point. If you miss work to go to a doctor, you still get a point. And it didn't take many points before you lose your job. Employers said, well, they have these financial concerns, and that may be why there was some underreporting. And then one of the most interesting things to me was that when they interviewed healthcare providers, they found that more than 50% reported pressure from employers to treat injuries as first aid so that they wouldn't have to record them. So OSHA did respond to that by, in 2010, doing a national emphasis program on record keeping. For about 1.5 years, the federal OSHA inspected 405 companies and really looked at record keeping, and they cited 269 employers, 809 citations, over $500,000 in fines. Just this year, in January, we expanded the record-keeping rules so that companies have to report all fatalities to us within 8 hours and all hospitalizations, amputations, and loss of an eye within 24 hours. And we have seen a big increase in reporting. We're hoping to actually get that up on the web so people can see it on our webpage. But we've got IT problems. When that gets resolved, we'll get that up. And then we also did November of 2013, we did a notice of proposed rulemaking to actually do some significant changes to the record-keeping rule that would require companies to electronically submit their OSHA 300 logs. So big companies greater than 250 employees would need to do that electronically. And then also companies with greater than 20 employees in high hazard industries would have to at least electronically submit a summary every year. So we're hoping that rule will come out in next year. So I'm in the Office of Occupational Medicine at OSHA and Occupational Medicine and Nursing, and how do we get involved in this? We get asked by the OSHA field staff to help them on questions around are injuries work-related, are they due to exposures at work, should they be on the OSHA 300 log. So we review OSHA 300 logs, we review medical records. And that's how we're kind of interested in this. And we noticed that, and have been noticing even long before I was at OSHA, a poor medical management practices. And what surprised me was how widespread these practices are, how institutionalized some of these practices have become, and how they have strayed from ethical health care. So let me show you what I mean, some examples. And you may understand what I mean by occupational medicine mills. These are clinics and healthcare organizations that deal in volume rather than quality. Clinics who allow companies to orchestrate the care of the workers, what to prescribe, when to return to work, they have their case managers actually sitting in on the visits with the workers. In this case here, this was a van company that had multiple vans that did screenings at the work sites, lots of companies, and they did respirator clearance screenings. They did about 3,000 a year. They only had one physician reviewing these respirator clearance exams, and that physician was doing it online. Generally did not visit the company, generally did not talk to the workers. And in this particular case, if he had talked with the worker, as the worker requested on the form, he may have been able to identify this occupational asthma and save this worker's life. We see audiology contract services that promise companies that they will decrease their standard threshold shifts on the OSHA 300 logs, and they deliver by deeming most, if not all, of those as non-work related. We see clinics and physicians who accept contracts from companies to do blood lead levels on their lead-exposed workers, but they do not review the results because the company won't pay for the review. And then we see these implant medical units, and that's what I'm going to be spending rest of my time on. These implant medical units, so might be called nursing stations or first aid stations. We've seen them particularly in poultry processing and warehouses. They're usually staffed by LPNs or EMTs. And this could be a good thing, you know, with good supervision and involvement with workplace health and safety. These could do some good things in the plants, but what we found is that the workers in these clinics lack appropriate supervision. They are working outside their scopes of practice. They have inadequate standard operating procedures, protocols, or directives. They have different names for them. And the clinics are used to discourage reporting of injuries by workers, and there's no incorporation into workplace health and safety programs, little or no. So I'm going to give you an example of what I mean. And this is a poultry processing plant in a rural area of the U.S., probably about a half hour away from any kind of medical care. They're 1,000 workers over two shifts, process 130,000 chickens per day, and most of them are immigrant workers. OSHA came to them because of a complaint about unsanitary working conditions, workers having to pay for their PPE, lack of safety and health training, but also discouraged from reporting. Workers were getting discouraged from reporting injuries, not getting appropriate medical care, not getting to see a doctor. So our office was consulted, and we accompanied the OSHA compliance officer to the plant and reviewed medical records, talked with workers, talked with the medical staff. Here's what we found. They had a nursing station that was kind of the size of a small exam room, staffed on each shift by an LPN. The LPNs were trained and supervised by the safety director, who was an EMT. We asked them to see their policies and procedures, and they had this kind of disorganized pile of papers. It almost looked like that. And these were their medical directives. We went through them. They were out of date. They were kind of written like SOPs for EMTs doing emergency care. Some cases there was wrong information or even possibly dangerous information. And then they had this nurse algorithm for the evaluation and treatment of musculoskeletal symptoms. And that included ice and heat packs and muscle gel and splints and lots of over-the-counter non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medicines. We then reviewed the logs, the nurses' logs, and what we found were that workers under these algorithms were seen multiple times with the same kind of treatment, returned to their regular jobs where probably that was where they were getting injured, without referral to a physician. When reading through these, we thought some of these, actually quite a number of these, were probably musculoskeletal disorders like carpal tunnel and trigger finger and that kind of thing, but not being diagnosed or seen by a doctor, treated by the LPNs. And also the nursing logs were not reviewed by anyone. There was no QA. It was actually an electronic system. They also told us that anyone could go in, the LPNs or their supervisor, and change things in their records without any documentation of who did it, what the changes were, or when it was done. So let me give you an illustrative case. This was a 42-year-old Hispanic woman with bilateral hand pain and paresthesias, numbness and tingling for about a month after starting on the D-bone line. So for those of you who weren't at the occupational health and safety lunch and did not get to see the last skit, I'll explain what the D-bone line is. So the D-bone line, you have chickens where their heads have been cut off, they've been eviscerated, and they're flipped over onto this metal bar, which is called a cone because sometimes they're shaped like cones. And they're going by on an assembly line, and a worker's doing the same movement, as they go by. It's 40 birds per minute, and the workers might do every chicken or every other chicken. So this is, at this plant, this is what our ergonomist found. So loading cones is the first part of the job, where they're putting the chicken on the cone. Then they use a knife for shoulder cut and wing cut, and they pull the wings off. Pulling skins, they're using a pinch grip to pull the skins off. Breast inspect actually is pinch gripping to pull the breast off, so it's not just inspect. And then tender cut's the last part. Again, they use knives to get the rest of the meat off. So the strain index is one validated method of assessing ergonomic hazard. It looks at repetition, force, awkward posture, work time, rest time. And anything above 6 is considered at high risk for ergonomic injuries. The higher the number, the higher the risk. Then the ACGIH hand activity level also looks at repetition and force. It doesn't look at awkward posture, but it's a quicker test. And anything above the threshold limit value, TLV, is considered at increased ergonomic risk. So, who can guess? Ooh, 5 minutes. Okay. So this is a very high ergonomic hazard job. What happened to our worker? She was seen at the nursing station repeatedly over two and a half months, actually, before referral to a doctor. She was seen multiple times, sometimes multiple times a day, given those treatments that I mentioned. I counted how many times. There were 94 times that she was seen before she was referred to a doctor. And she was always returned to her regular job. So 5 months later, she was finally diagnosed with carpal tunnel syndrome. She had injections. They weren't working. When I talked to her, surgery was being planned, and she had been permanently transferred out of the D-bone line. So how does this relate to under-recording and under-reporting? Now, we found this worker because she was on the 300 log. But, you know, as I said, we saw multiple nurses' logs of D-bone workers who had similar symptoms and symptoms suggestive of musculoskeletal disorders. And what workers said was that, you know, they would go to the clinic or to the medical unit and they weren't getting better, so maybe they stopped going. Or they were afraid to go too much because they were afraid they were going to get fired. Or they just went to their own doctors. But also, this plant had a huge turnover rate of 200% and 300%, so lots of these workers that we saw in the logs, they were gone. We didn't know where they were. We've been seeing the same kind of thing in other plants and the same kind of problems that I mentioned about supervision, scope of practice. Also, in some places, very disrespectful conduct to workers. And, you know, so it's being used in administrative function to weed out workers, to under-record and under-report. And, you know, they have this database they could use to assess trends and actually make some changes, and in most places they're not doing that. So what are the effects on these poor medical management practices, under-reporting, under-recording, and inaccurate data? And for workers, you know, they're having the most direct effects in terms of progression of their injuries, chronic disability. For employers, you know, they could use this data actually to put in place prevention and interventions. For researchers, and in our case ergonomists, they don't have the data they can use to investigate root causes. And I also think that for healthcare providers, this creates poor practice habits. There's certainly questionable ethics. And in some cases, depending on the state laws, they may, and working outside their scopes of practice, they may be actually working illegally and that may be a threat to their licenses. So what can we do? That's why I'm here. So OSHA is doing some things. We're citing companies for record-keeping violations. We're citing companies under general duty clause. And we're also writing hazard alert letters to companies, and what's in those hazard alerts kind of depends on what's going on at the plant. But here you can read some of the things that we've made recommendations to the company about, to various companies. What's most important, I think, is early referral for appropriate medical evaluation and treatment. So what can we do? You know, APHA is a great venue to think about other ways we can handle this issue or work on this issue. And one is to tell these stories and ways raise awareness to professionals. And also, you know, help professionals figure out how to use their codes of ethics in these kinds of situations. So another thing is writing guidance about these implant medical units that talk about appropriate supervision and appropriate medical directives and that kind of thing, and get worker input, so best practices. And then I think finally, and I'm just about done, we really need multidisciplinary collaboration. Nurses, physicians, EMTs, physical therapists, there's a lot of them in the plants. And We all tend to sit in our own silos. We need to get together and think, because occupational medicine and medicine in general, the practice is changing. So we need to all talk together about how to improve occupational safety and health in the workplace. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fagan. I want to thank you for mentioning Crystal Eastman, because I did not have that information. I was looking for it. Also, just to remind you, questions will be asked at the end. And our next speaker is Michael Foley. Michael Foley is the Safety and Health Assessment and Research for Prevention Programs of the Washington State Department of Labor and Industries. His primary research interests include the impact of occupational health and safety regulations on worker injury rates and costs, the implications, the implications, the growth of the contingent workforce and worker safety and health, and the long-term burden of occupational injury for workers. He also assists with a project to address the issue of assaults on staff in psychiatric hospitals. Thank you.